Hello, I'm Kate Shingler. This is number 0199, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0199. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet storm chaser George Karunas, who talks about being in Oklahoma to witness the largest tornado ever.
The path width was 2.6 miles across. That's 4.2 kilometers wide. That's a new world record. The wind speed was over 476 kilometers per hour.
A retro interview from 2002 with the legendary Esther Williams, who passed away this past week at the age of 91.
MGM came up to see me, and I couldn't believe they were going to make a swimming musical. It seemed to me that that was a one-picture thing that could happen, and then you'd never do it again. But they had seen the grosses of Sonja Henie and her ice skating pictures, and they said, let's just melt the ice and toss a swimmer in there and see what happens. I said, God, they're ready for mackerel now to be stars, so we'll see what we can do. And I just did my best. I was there for 18 years, and I was in the top 10 box office for 7 years.
Yelena Popovich, who is a writer, producer, and co-director, and also the star of the film L.A. Superheroes, Illegal in Hollywood. It's a collection of real-life stories from those behind the film. Where did the title come from?
The reason I called it L.A. Superheroes, which was the idea of my co-writer, which I think it was great, Alexander Ziadis, is because everybody who comes to Los Angeles has a dream and works hard, doesn't give up, and doesn't sell out is a superhero.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0199, was Kate Shingler, who's the managing editor at Global News here in Montreal, the other place that I work. And thank you very much, Kate, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, when David Spires arrived at his Winnipeg, Manitoba home, he was preoccupied with getting his sick dog into the house. A short time later, I remembered my car being unlocked. I never leave it unlocked. So I reached out the front door with my remote key and locked my car, Spires said. Unbeknownst to me, I had just locked a thief into the car. That became very evident shortly when the BMW's alarm went off and the thief kicked out the window to escape. Spires got outside in time to see the thief leave on a bicycle. When he surveyed the damage to the car, he found that, in his hurry, the thief dropped his own keys, some money, and his wallet, which included his ID. A 31-year-old man was arrested and not named, the newspaper said, because he is presumed innocent. Whereas, I'm sure the newspaper's readers will simply figure he's just presumed stupid. By the way, this guy was not made the idiot of the day. Mind you, that does come later, so stick around. A young man of 16 had had a tense relationship with his father's 28-year-old girlfriend. His father set up a video camera in the house in hopes of capturing evidence of paranormal activity while he was at work, but that's not the activity that the camera caught. Instead, he got video of his girlfriend and his son kissing and cuddling, and the son admitted that he'd been having sex with her. The father called police. The woman, who has pleaded guilty to 5 counts of sexual intercourse with a young person, says she accepts that this is not a relationship that can or will continue. Actually, that's the words of her lawyer. The woman is trying to reconcile with the boy's father, who is also the father of her young child. This is like Peyton Place. I don't know. You know, this guy had a camera in his house to capture paranormal activity. Well, this house clearly isn't haunted. But this family will be. Eee, that's kinda creepy. I don't know if you're thinking the same thing I am, but as I mentioned, this guy is the father of this woman's young child. Is he absolutely sure about that? I'm just saying. We go to St. Clair County, Illinois. A circuit court judge there by the name of Michael Cook, who was 43, has resigned after a cascading series of bad news. Now, follow along with this one, shall you? Cook normally presided over county-prosecuted drug cases. While on a hunting trip with Cook, Associated Circuit Judge Joe Christ, a former county prosecutor, died in Cook's cabin from a cocaine overdose. County probation officer James K. Fogarty, age 45, admits he provided the cocaine to both Cook and Christ and said the three of them had used the drug together many times. Now, when Cook was arrested, he was at the house of Sean McGilvery, who was 34, who is described as Cook's friend and former client, and I'm doing air quotes here. McGilvery is a heroin dealer, police say. Boy, are you following along all the dots on this story? When arrested, Cook was wearing a T-shirt reading, "Bad is my middle name." The judge was charged with heroin possession and possessing a firearm while illegally using controlled drugs. He faces 10 years in prison and $350,000 in fines, but was released for drug treatment without posting bond. Cook has accepted responsibility, and that has allowed us to move ahead, according to Chief Judge John Barasevich. Cook has pleaded not guilty to the charges. Well, Judge Barasevich has an interesting interpretation of accepting responsibility, considering he's pleading not guilty. But I digress. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Antonio Bueno is 73 years old. He's a parking lot attendant for the city of Lawrence, Massachusetts, and has a long history of traffic citations, accidents, and license suspensions. His driving record shows 24 incidents over the past 17 years. Did I mention he's a parking lot attendant? Yeah. I used to be a parking lot attendant too, by the way, but my record was nothing like his. I'm just saying that right now. Now, what I said about Antonio perhaps explains why Bueno thought nothing of jumping into someone's car to move it to make room in the parking lot next to City Hall. He put the car into reverse and backed up, promptly crashing into another car, which happened to be his own. He then shoved the gear shift into forward and hit the gas and smashed into the car owned by the city's purchasing agent, hitting it so hard that it was totaled. Totaled. City parking lot attendants have no business being in anyone's vehicle except their own, according to the Public Works Director, John Essenzi. We don't valet park cars. The city purchasing agent was particularly upset. I love that car, said Rita Brasso. It was my first brand new car, right off the lot. It was fully loaded. I planned on running that thing into the ground. Well, I guess Antonio had heard of her plans and beat her to it. Yikes. Anyway, on to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. George Karunas is a renowned global adventurer, storm chaser, explorer, and television presenter. He documents nature's worst weather conditions, and that's taken him around the world. Now, most recently, he's been in Oklahoma where tornadoes devastated the area, claiming many lives, including some other seasoned professional storm chasers. George is on the line with us right now via Skype-to-Skype communications from Toronto. Hi, George.
Hi, Peter.
Nice to have you back home safely, first of all. It's watching the footage on television. It's terrifying to see it on TV. It can't in any way, shape, or form compare to actually being there.
It's kind of hard to put into perspective what this tornado season has been like. It started off slow, but then really, really started ramping up. And I just found out today that the El Reno tornado from Friday just got its rating upgraded from F3 to F5, the strongest rating that that there is due to some new radar data that they got from it. And the path width was 2.6 miles across. That's 4.2 kilometers wide. That's a new world record. The wind speed was over about 476 kilometers per hour.
Wow. In light of what has happened, the deaths that I mentioned in the introduction, and we should mention the names, Tim Samaras, his son Paul Samaras, and Carl Young, they were near El Reno on Friday when this thing hit. Did you know these gentlemen, first of all?
Well, they were colleagues and acquaintances. It was always nice to see Tim out on the chase. Whenever I saw him on the same storm, I always knew that I was in the right place. Those guys were extremely well-respected. They knew their stuff. They were top-notch tornado researchers. And it was always always nice to bump into Tim, especially after a chase when we would meet at a restaurant or something late at night after a storm chase and discuss the day's you know, the day's events, that kind of thing. So it was just total shock of all the people out there, and it's a very small community. Everyone knows everyone else. Nobody could have anticipated him being the literally the first storm chaser to be killed by the storm that they were chasing. This has never happened before.
And we should mention that he's been at it for 25 years. He was a veteran of this. And I'm not making, and I don't think anyone should make light of this situation, but we watched this on television. And sometimes people think, you know, you guys are just thrill seekers, but you're also scientists. I mean, you're getting information that makes it easier and more helpful for weather services to document these storms, correct?
Yes, and especially Tim. I mean, that was his thing. He had, I believe, 18 different research grants from the National Geographic Society, and that was like his thing. And he developed a camera that could fire off a million frames per second for studying lightning. And he would put instrumented probes in the path of tornadoes, and literally the best storm researcher in the world. And what happens is when you get a lot of people out there, it gets confusing on the roads. This storm took the textbooks on severe weather, ripped it to shreds, and threw it out the window. This storm was not what we expected that day. The shape was strange. The behavior of the storm was strange. The tornado got very wide, obviously world record width, very quickly. It got wrapped up in rain. It was difficult to see. So even if you were literally a 30-year veteran, if you just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, the tornado was so big that even if you tried to escape, you just could not get out of there in time.
Well, one of the things I've always been fascinated about in watching this video is that you guys are on roads. It's not like you can travel, as the saying goes, as the crow flies.
Exactly.
So if this thing changes direction, there's only one of two ways you can go.
Well, yes, and that's part of the strategy. That's what makes a good storm chaser is knowing how to navigate around these storms given the road network that is available to you. And that means plotting out escape routes in your head. If things go south, you know, things go bad, which direction can I go? And then you get little wild cards thrown in there. Things like downed power lines, trees that are down, dirt roads that when they get wet turn to pudding that you can't even drive on with a four-wheel drive vehicle, which is very common in that part of the world with the red clay soil that they have there. So it's very easy for your escape routes to be just checked off the list, you know, unavailable, unavailable, unavailable. So you really, really have to be conservative in your strategy.
We have social media, things like YouTube that just feeds on video 24/7. We have television channels, cable networks that feed on video 24/7, which makes it a situation where people want to get more and more video. Does that make the job, quite frankly, more dangerous because you have to feed the beast that is cable news and the audience's insatiable thirst for this stuff?
Absolutely. That is part of the problem. Not that there's a problem, but that's part of the reality of it these days. And actually, many, many storm chasers, including myself, stream live video over the internet from a cell phone connection as we're chasing. So this tornado was out there on the internet live as it was occurring, as many of them have been over the past couple of years. And you're right, the news media is insatiable. They want the latest, craziest video. The more screaming, the better. The more panicked the people are, the better. And it's, I find it distasteful because it just makes us look foolish, and it encourages other people to be reckless. And I don't know what we can do about that, because we're just getting more and more news outlets and more internet sites that are just gobbling up this stuff. And what is even worse is that the bottom has actually fallen out in terms of marketability. I used to be able to make a fair amount of money by selling video to news agencies. And that doesn't happen anymore, because everybody has an iPhone in their pocket. They can shoot video and email it directly to CNN or whoever, and they encourage people to submit their video, and we'll put your name on the screen. Ooh, you know, so there's all these people risking their lives who don't know what they're doing in order to get 15 seconds of fame, and it's just not worth the price.
One of the videos that's making a lot of the rounds on television, it's been all over the place since the storm, is the one with the three storm chasers who get caught in it, and you see at one point their windshield wipers are just literally ripped off the vehicle as they're driving along. I've heard it said that if you get video as dramatic as this, you're already too close.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. You're too close, and you're lucky to be alive. These are not things to be trifled with. And I'll admit, right off the bat, I've had some close calls. I have been too close in the past. Not during this particular El Reno tornado. I was actually in a very good position for it, and I wasn't frightened for my safety because I was behind it, tracking it. But there have been times over the past 15 years where I have been afraid, I've been too close, the tornado has maybe made a sharp left turn and caught me off guard. And it happens. You have to have respect for the storm. And I think that's what's lacking out there right now, is some of this respect that you need to have that will help keep you alive. There are old storm chasers and there are bold storm chasers, but there are no old, bold storm chasers.
With the unpredictability of this current storm and the tragedy that has befallen three storm chasers because of it, does this make you rethink how you will do things in the future?
Well, yeah, it does. Of course, whenever you have colleagues that perish in a situation like this, it makes you second guess what you're doing and your strategies. But when you look at it from a purely statistical point of view, this is the very first instance of a tornado killing a storm chaser that has been chasing it. That has never happened before. The activity has been very safe if you know what you're doing. And the fact that it was one of the most regarded researchers who was killed really goes to show that even if you know your stuff and if you do everything right, you can still be caught off guard. Mother Nature is always in charge in the situation, and it's very easy to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. So, will I change my way of chasing? Well, I'm certainly not going to stop doing it, but I will certainly give second thoughts to chasing in populated areas, especially around the Oklahoma City area, where the traffic congestion just totally compounds the danger.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the size of the one that was in El Reno. You talk about the fact that it's 2.6 miles across, or 4.2 kilometers. It was definitely an E5, and it had winds of 476 kilometers. In your years of chasing storms, literally around the world, is this one of the biggest or the biggest you've ever seen?
It's the biggest anyone has ever seen. This is literally the new Guinness World Record holder for the largest tornado ever seen and documented. So I've never seen anything like it. No one has. And it was just a monster. It didn't even look like a tornado. You could just see the edge of it in the rain. And then I glance over and I see a few explosions from power flashes. And I can barely see the other edge of the tornado in the rain. And I realize my camera is on full wide angle and it just barely fit in the frame. And luckily I was coming up behind it. I could sort of slowly creep up to it and avoid getting in the path of the thing. But wow, it was unlike anything I'd ever seen. It wasn't photogenic. It wasn't pretty. It was big. It was mean. It meant business, and you wanted to stay away from it.
You're back home in Toronto right now after being out for a month. Your wife must be very happy for you to have you back in the house. But what's
yes or no?
But what's next for you?
Oh, I've always got so much on the plate right now. I've got a bunch of speaking engagements around Ontario coming up that I'm going to be doing. And then in August, I'm going to be blasting off up to Baffin Island, hopping on an icebreaker, and then taking it across to Greenland, going up and down the coast, filming for the Weather Network, and then coming back across north of Baffin Island, and then traveling through the entire Northwest Passage. It's going to be spectacular. Basically, the entire month of August, I'll be up in the high Arctic. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, people can check out information by going on your website, which is furiousearth.com. George, I thank you once again for being on the program with us, and stay safe.
My pleasure. Thank you. I will. I promise. It's always a treat.
Storm chaser George Karunas. Again, his website is furiousearth.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0199, and you'll find links to George's website.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. This is The Stuff File.
It's time for another retro interview with a celebrity that is no longer with us. This time around, it's a chat I had back in June of 2002, and it's with someone who left us just recently. This was a woman who was more familiar to us in the water than she was to us on land, the legendary Hollywood swim star, Esther Williams. Esther managed to parlay her swimming career into various successful businesses long after her Hollywood days were over. We spoke with Esther just as she was about to embark on a new show in Las Vegas. It was a chance to reminisce about her successful past. Here is part of that conversation now. People, of course, know you from the films you did, from your swimming days. I guess a whole generation, and the generation I'm talking about is mine and those that followed, would have discovered you when That's Entertainment came out. Back in the 70s. As a matter of fact, I worked as a theater usher, so I saw that movie over and over and over again. I loved it.
Oh.
And it was not my introduction to Esther Williams, because I'd seen some of your films, but hearing a little bit about the backstory was rather interesting. Now, you were a swimming phenom as a little kid, basically, and you swam on swim teams, what, in the L.A. area?
Yes, the Los Angeles Athletic Club would scout the swimming meets, the city playground meets, to find prospective swimmers, and I was certainly that. And I had just, I had inaugurated a city playground, Manchester City Playground, which is the southwest of Los Angeles, and my mother was quite a lady. She got things done. She was a take-charge lady, and she saw that the playground had places for people to play baseball, but no swimming pools. So she went down to the parks and recreation, and she said, I have a daughter that wants to swim. And they said, how old is she? And she said, 8 years old. And they said, well, so what do we do? She said, you put a swimming pool in that Manchester playground, Manchester Avenue, where I went to school, and she'll donate her time to inaugurating it for you. And they said, what does that mean? She said, she'll swim across, and you give her a little medal, and she will think it's the Olympics. She'll be very happy. And so my mother, who really a very kind of wonderful, ahead-of-her-time lady had done what lobbyists hadn't been able to do in protests and marchers. She said, you have to treat the women right, and little girls are going to be women someday. So you make a swimming pool in that playground for her, and she'll pay you back by being a champion. And they said, golly, Beulah Williams, you certainly do make a case. And they built a swimming pool because of my mother. And I swam in that pool at 8 years. I was probably nine by the time I did that swim across the pool. And when I got out of the water and everybody applauded, I said, oh, this is fun. I like the applause. And I still do.
Well, that's great. Obviously, your mother was a very, very strong-willed woman.
Oh, I just love Beulah Williams because she had, I was her fifth child, and she'd been awfully busy raising my four brothers and sisters. But by the time she got to the fifth one, she turned to my older sister, Maureen, and said, you raise this one. I'm going to go out and find out what's going on in the world. She was very liberated very early. And my sister Maureen taught me to swim. She took me to the beach on the streetcar. And we managed. We didn't have any money, but we sure had a lot of do it. Do it. Like Nike says, just do it.
A lot of people, when they're young, learn how to swim. Some people get into competition. But when did you know you were a cut above the rest, or did you?
Well, I didn't know, but I knew that it was the best I was going to feel all day to get in that pool. And what I did, that I had no idea the benefits that I would reap from that. I swam with the lifeguards in the swimming pool, and they were the best coaches I ever had because they were so supple and those lovely long muscles, strong, that they saved people with. Were the most wonderful teachers in the world, and I'd swim laps with them and match them stroke for stroke. And by the time I got into competitive swimming, because the athletic club, LA Athletic Club, came and found me, and I had just won the 50 meters in a swimming meet, city playground meet, and they said, that little girl can swim, and they put me on the team.
So by 16, you were you represented the L.A. Athletic Club swim team, right?
Right. At 15, actually, because
15.
At 16, I won the 100-meter freestyle. And because of those lifeguards, I learned to swim butterfly breaststroke long before women, or men for that matter, were even doing that. That's where you throw the arms forward. But instead of in the water, you're out of the water, so it's like a double crawl. It makes you awfully strong to swim that stroke. And strong was what I needed to win races.
You made the U.S. Olympic swim team for the 1940 Games in Helsinki. Unfortunately, those games were canceled because of World War II.
Well, they figured that with Germany bombing our boats and our planes and everything going over to Europe, the games were scheduled for Helsinki, Finland. And at that time, there was a preoccupation to occupy the Scandinavian countries, and they didn't want our swimmers to risk their lives. And I'm grateful to them for that because our boat might have gone down. It was a very precarious time. But there again, that positive mother, I said, Mom, there's not going to be an Olympics. And she said, well, you can't eat medals. What are you going to do? I said, well, I've had an offer to go become professional and be paid for swimming with Billy Rose's Aquacade. And she said, well, honey, there won't be another Olympics for 8 years, and she was exactly right. Her predicament came true. Her prediction came true. In London, in 1948, was the next Olympics. They had to get that war over with. And so I swam in the Billy Rose's Aquacade, and that's where MGM found me.
Now, did you ever felt that you had missed out by being at the Olympics? Or, I mean, when you look back at all the things you've done in your career?
Well, I heard a story once about Harry Truman, and he had a haberdashery shop in Independence, Missouri, and he failed at that. He wasn't a good salesman. He didn't make that go. And somebody once said to Harry, "Why couldn't you make your haberdashery shop a success?" He said, "Well, it went broke." But he said, "As a consolation prize, they made me president of the United States." And I took that story and said, "If there can't be an Olympics, I'll become a star and I'll be in the movies." And I was.
So you go to Billy Rose's Aquacade, and from there, you're discovered by MGM, is it?
MGM came up to see me, and I couldn't believe they were going to make a swimming musical. It seemed to me that that was a one-picture thing that could happen, and then you'd never do it again. But they had seen the grosses of Sonia Henie and her ice skating pictures, and she was an athlete and a champion, and they said, "Let's just melt the ice and toss a swimmer in there and see what happens." And that was me. I was a swimmer. And I said, "God, they're ready for mackerels now to be stars, so we'll see what we can do." And I just did my best. And I was there for 18 years, and I was in the top 10 box office for 7 years, one after another big movie that made it at the box office. And I figured that was my Harry Truman consolation prize. Now, it was better than being president of the United States.
When MGM first came to you, did you have any acting experience, any school plays, anything like that?
Nothing. I never even got an autograph. I said to them, when they told me that they were going to sign me to a contract, I said, "Well, you people have a lot of courage, because I can't sing and I can't act and I can't dance, but I can sure swim. And if you think you can make a movie out of that, I congratulate you. But if you don't want me, just throw me back in the pool. I'll be okay." That was my mother's theory about everything, and I guess I picked that up.
Did you have a role in how some of those stories, some of those movies that you were in, were conceived?
Oddly enough, what happened, Peter, is everybody was dry. They weren't wet people, and they didn't understand the swimming. They were like I was. They couldn't believe they were making a musical with a swimmer. And what you have to do when you get into a situation like that is learn fast. You have to pay attention. You have to learn what you don't know, which is how to act, it took me a while to understand that that camera keeps rolling no matter what happens, and you better do what they say. And I learned quickly. I was only 17 when I went there, and it's been such a wonderful life. I've enjoyed it so much.
You mentioned that you have this new project you're working on. Tell us about that.
Along with my mother's positive thinking, I quit making movies because I could see there was not another way to get me into a bathing suit, into the water. And the times changed. The musical as we knew it had changed. It had disappeared. When Julie Andrews can be the biggest box office in the history of movies in Sound of Music, and then nobody went to see her in a movie called Darlin' Lily, which was right after the big truth of Sound of Music, I could read the handwriting on the wall. And all along, I knew when I saw Eleanor Powell's feet bleeding because she danced too much, and when Crawford was so brokenhearted because nobody wanted her anymore in pictures. I said, there's an end to this thing. And I think when you have this kind of success, you better hedge your bet. And so I went into business, and I had my swimming pool business in 1958 that had a big success because timing is everything in life, and there was a gas shortage, and nobody could get to their favorite watering hole or lake or river or whatever. So I said, they've got to have a swimming pool in the backyard, and it needs to be affordable and in fast because everybody signs up for a swimming pool and they want it yesterday. So I had tremendous success with a thing called the Esther Williams Swimming Pool. Then I decided that my name should be on a bathing suit, and that went well, and that's still going on. I'm on a website where people can buy it on the internet. Business seemed to be the perfect segue to show business because you both of those things deal with the audience, and you give them something that makes sense for you to endorse, like a swimming pool for Esther Williams and a bathing suit for Esther Williams, and it's appropriate. And what they say is, I've always wanted to look like her in the water, so I've got to get a suit that will make me look like her. And so I designed them very carefully after things I'd worn in the pictures, because I had wonderful designers in the MGM. And all of those things seem to have their moment of timing, and they're still going strong.
It sounds like the wisdom of Beulah Williams raised its head again in you, in the fact that so many actors and actresses don't know when to quit or if they should quit. And you seem to see the writing on the wall and make a change before someone else made the change for you.
Yes. And it's very embarrassing to fail and then try to do it. So you quit at the top. And I was top 10 box office at that time. But I knew it couldn't go on forever. When they have to come up with crazy ideas to get me into the water, I said they're all waiting for a light bulb to go off in their heads, and they weren't swimmers. They didn't understand it. The underwater tank that I used to do my underwater work in had a big window in it, and one day I said to Mervyn LeRoy, who was directing me, he was a very famous director, directing me in Million Dollar Mermaid, which was a wonderful number movie because Busby Berkeley, they found him and delivered him to me.
Was that the one you were water skiing in?
No, the water ski was Dangerous When Wet.
Dangerous When Wet, yes, okay.
But Million Dollar Mermaid was the story of Annette Kellerman, who, talk about trendsetters, who was barred from Boston because she had taken a man's swimsuit and sewn black stockings in it because you had to cover the limbs in those days because it was all ruffles and bows at that time, and ladies had shoes on and umbrellas, and they weren't anything resembling a swimsuit. And that was the script of Million Dollar Mermaid. And she was an Australian. I met her. She came on the set one day, and I said, do you mind me playing your life? And she said, well, the only objection I have is you're not Australian. And I said, oh, Annette, dear, you're 90 years old, and we're doing the story of your life, and I'm the only swimmer in the movie, so I'm what you're stuck with. But I loved meeting her because she was a heroine to me.
Now, with all the swimming that you've done in the movies, and it's not easy, take after take after take, some of the things that crossed my mind, especially when I saw Dance Entertainment, is how did you deal with things like, you know, there's chlorine in the pool? Was there any concerns with what it was doing to your skin, your hair? And considering you had to be in makeup for the movies, was this a problem?
Well, it's no problem because it was before doctors have us so scared about melanoma on our skin, because I kept a good tan all year round because body makeup came off in the water. They had water-soluble pancake and things like that, that I'd dive in the water and I'd see a cloud of body makeup on the surface of the water. I'd say, well, that's all off. Good thing I've got a tan under here. But what happens with swimming? I don't know. I probably discovered this and nobody else knew it except scuba divers know it. The longer you're in the water, the more you're swimming. Like what you can do in staying underwater at 9 o'clock in the morning, you can do twice as well, three times as well at 4:30 in the afternoon because you've been in the water all day. And somehow the body, in its miraculous ability to adjust, switches over. I used to check my mirror to see if I grew gills. It's like a fish because I could stay. We worked on a number with Tom and Jerry. Did you happen to see
that? Yes. Yes, that was great.
It was such fun because that was underwater acting because they weren't there. They were sketched in later, you know, with Hannah and Barbara. And they showed me what the storyboard was, how the mouse and the cat helped me swim the English Channel, which was the script of that one. And I had index cards that told me the story, and I'd study each day that we worked. We worked for about 10 days on that, underwater, every day, all day. And it was amazing. I found that at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I could stay on longer than I could at night, be underwater longer than I was at 9 o'clock in the morning. So talk about flexible. That's what you better be if you're going to be an athlete in the movies.
That was part of an interview with Esther Williams. Esther died recently in her sleep on June 6, 2013, at the age of 91. You can hear the full interview with Esther on my website at thestufffile.com. Click on to Celebrity Audio Files, and you'll find the interview with Esther and also interviews with others. They are all listed in alphabetical order, and you can play them right off the page.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. We just announced the finalists in our annual Wacky Warning Label contest, and after 16 years, I can tell you they're as outrageous as ever. One of the labels came on a common indoor extension cord. It warns, wash hands after using. Another label was found on a box of wood matches, the kind that have been used for hundreds of years. Even though there have been no reports of any injuries ever being caused by this, it warns that the lit match will emit carbon monoxide. Let's be fair, the only reason those warnings are there is because the state of California has a law that requires special warnings when certain chemicals are present in a product, even if the chemicals pose no threat to consumers. These useless warnings cost product makers thousands of dollars, but if they don't put them there, they can be sued and even be forced out of business. To see these labels and the other three finalists in our contest this year, and to find out how you can enter, visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we do indeed have an idiot of the day on a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But we're running out of time very quickly, so let's get right to our next guest here on The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. L.A. Superheroes, Illegal in Hollywood is a new film by Yelena Popovich. Yelena wrote, produced, co-directed, and stars in this dramatic comedy. The film is a collection of real-life stories witnessed firsthand by the struggling artists that would go on to put this project together. Yelena is on the line with us right now from California to talk about her new film. Hi, Yelena.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for being on the program with us. First of all, just the title of the film, L.A. Superheroes. Where did the title come from?
Yeah, everybody's asking me that. Well, even though this is a story of a struggling immigrant, L.A. Superheroes, since it talks about Los Angeles and all the crazy stories in L.A. as well, is basically, the reason I called it L.A. Superheroes, which was the idea of my co-writer, which I think it was great, Alexander Ziadis, is because everybody who comes to Los Angeles has a dream and works hard, doesn't give up and doesn't sell out is a superhero. So that's why the title is L.A. Superheroes.
Now, as I said in the introduction, there are a lot of people in this involved in this film who kind of have real-life stories similar to the plot line. Is that correct?
Yeah, basically it's based on the true story, my true story. But there are a lot of little stories that most of them, they're very funny, and they really happen, all the crazy L.A. stories in the movie.
One of the things, though, there's an undercurrent, because I said dramatic comedy, so there's some drama in there as well. There is the undercurrent of how there are people out there who will take advantage of someone who is attempting to come to the United States or Canada and do the right thing, correct?
Yes, that's correct. That is my experience. Being an immigrant, having to wait 18 years to get my citizenship, I have to struggle a lot. And the movie really shows the struggle of an immigrant.
Okay, so 18 years you went through this. Was there ever a time where you said, I don't know if this is worth it, or did you... Especially when, you know, you reach a certain period of time and you don't know if it's going to be another 18 years. Were you ever discouraged through the process?
Well, it was, of course, it's very discouraging. It was very difficult. But for me, coming from a country like ex-Yugoslavia, now I'm Serbian, actually, that's now Serbia, where the war broke out and I came with good intentions to make something happen, and worked very hard. At one point, you cannot just go back. You know, a place where you live, you spend most of your adult years, becomes your home, whether you like it or not. And just going back would not be your home anymore. So I simply had no choice but to work through that. And having faith, and I can say, thank God, it something good happened for me at the end.
So at what point, and I don't even think we mentioned, you started working, I mean, you're an actress, you're a writer, you're a director, mm-hmm. but you started working as a model, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Okay.
At what point did you say, I've got a story here that I want to tell and I want to put into film and share with an audience?
Okay, well, here's how it happened. I started as a model, and I was a teenager. I came to the U.S. when I was about to turn 18. But by the age of 20, 21, because I had a lot of issues with papers, immigration papers, at one point I couldn't leave the country without being able to come back in. I couldn't really pursue modeling anymore, so that was outside of the window. So I focused on acting. And that was a long process as well. It's a tough business. And I wrote a couple of scripts. I wrote one script about Greta Garbo. It's called Loveless. And that movie, finally, after many years, was about to get into production, me playing the lead. But because I didn't have a name in Hollywood, it really fell apart at the end. And I did not take up an offer of the producers to basically sell my film and have somebody else who has a name play it. I wrote something else. That didn't work out. It was less money involved. And then I said, well, wait a second. How can I actually make a movie and be able to star in it and have it as my own production? So I wrote something based, that's how I thought of my own life story of a struggling immigrant, aging actress, model in Hollywood, and I thought there was a movie there. And after all these years, basically, after 10 years in Hollywood, I came up with that story, I wrote the script, and we made a movie because we did it ourselves. You know, we didn't need anybody. We didn't have to wait for anybody's money, for anybody to do anything, and that's how it happened.
You just said a sentence in there, a phrase in there that most models don't like to hear. You said the term aging model. That is, that mm-hmm. makes people cringe, doesn't it?
Well, you know, I mean, as soon as you turn 20, you become aging in modeling. So which is kind of scary. But then, I don't know, now maybe the bar has lowered. Maybe it's 18. I mean, I've been out of that world for a little bit. And as far as acting, if you don't have some major credits, and if you're in your 20s, it's already a problem. So, I had to do it myself. And I said, I'm not going to give up. I have good stories. I was able to pull it off. So I'm very happy and grateful for that.
Sometimes when you're working on something, you tend to have blinders on and you focus on the project at hand. And you just work and work and work and work and work. But this is your story. Have you had an opportunity to take a step back now that it's done and look at this movie and say, oh, my gosh, that's my story?
I think that moment will come. I don't know. It's been so hectic lately. I'm not only an actress, ex-model, but I'm a mother of two. One is 2.5 years old, my son Nikolai. The other one is just turned 13. So I don't think I had a moment, to be honest with you. I think I would need probably a couple of more months before I will be able to do that.
Was it cathartic at least to do this movie for you?
I thought it was a really great story, and I wanted to share it with people. You know, I felt like there was a good message in it. I felt that it has it's a good story of integrity and not selling out and sticking to your guns and showing that, hey, you know, good things can happen to people that don't give up and try to keep real and being honest to themselves and others.
So what is the plans for this film as far as distribution is concerned and getting it out there to the general public about, you know, besides, you know, talking to folks like myself? What are your hopes and plans for this film to reach a broader audience?
Okay, well, this is what we did. The movie is coming out in Los Angeles in two theaters, and it's coming out on June 21st. And that's going to be just the opening in one city. We felt that Los Angeles is a good place to, you know, open up first. And we are planning on hopefully doing it in other cities in the United States, but L.A. is probably the best market to test it at. And it's coming out at Lenly Theaters in North Hollywood and at AMC Burbank 8, and it will come out on June 21st. So that's, and see what happens. You know, if the public is going to like it or not, that nobody can predict that. Even much bigger and greater movies have failed, so I can't say anything about that.
With all that you've done in this movie, as I said, you know, wrote, produced, co-directed, and starring in, do you have a chance now, or will you have an opportunity to take a bit of a breather?
Well, my plan is to actually be able to do the Garbo project, because I believe that's a very strong script, and it's a great story about this Hollywood actress. And I hope I will get a chance, because of doing this film, to be able to produce and play in that film. That is my plan. So hopefully that's going to happen.
Again, you're a strong, determined woman who doesn't take no for an answer. So what is it about Garbo that is so important for you to do that movie?
Okay, this is how it started with Garbo. I was told, on not just in Hollywood, but on like silly occasions in a deposition in the courtroom, the grocery stores, everywhere I went, I was told how much I remind people of this woman, Greta Garbo. Sure, I knew who she was. She was a famous actress. But then when I did the research about her, I realized there were things in her life that are really personal to me, that I believe the world should know about, and she was an incredibly strong woman in 20s and 30s, a woman who was able to stand up to studio executives at the time, where if you were even rebelling in any way, you were simply fired and you never made another movie. And she was able to go through all that and have an amazingly successful career. And I felt that it's a great story to tell, and I felt that I can really portray her well and show who she was. Not that I can be Garbo, nobody can be Garbo, but I believe that I can really show people something about this woman that was very remarkable and that had a lot of integrity and guts.
Well, judging by your
determination, that's why I would like to do it.
Judging by your determination, I have no doubt that you'll succeed. I look forward to seeing that happen. In the meantime, your current film is called L.A. Superheroes, Illegal in Hollywood. People can check out the website, which is LASuperheroesTheMovie.com. And I thank you very, very much, Yelena, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much.
Yelena Popovich. Again, the film is L.A. Superheroes, Illegal in Hollywood. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0199, and you'll find links to the film's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Paul Gardner and Chad Leakey were arrested in Tempe, Arizona in May and charged with a spree of car burglaries. According to police, the men were trying various car doors, looking for any of them that were unlocked, when they inadvertently opened the back door of an unmarked police car. The men had apparently not noticed, until it was too late, that two uniformed officers were sitting in the front seat and also failed to notice that cage wiring separated the back seat from the front seat. Wow. Why, oh why, would crooks not even check out a vehicle thoroughly before hopping into the back seat? One reason, and one reason only, they're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0199. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0199. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.